Ready to switch and talk about the issue of communications, a very vital topic for all of us in any of relationships. Jim, whom we'd never met, identified himself at a Washington, D.C. airport by holding up a copy of our book, Marriage Takes More Than Love. After we had met him, we drove out to a suburb to pick up his wife, and as she piled in the front seat, she turned to us in the back seat, and she said, "How'd y'all meet?" Well, that's one of our very favorite questions, not only to ask, but to be asked. But fortunately, this time, Jack chose to answer the short version. And he said, "We met in college." This lady flushed, stammered, and then sort of frustrated, she said, "I mean, how did Jim find you at the airport?" And I thought, thank you, Lord, that Jack chose the short version. Communication is difficult in the best of circumstances. Sometimes we're as confused as the people at the airport who heard this announcement over the loudspeaker. Will all those Piedmont passengers who have not done so, please do so immediately? True communication involves more than speaking. And it involves more than listening, and it involves more than a combination of the two. Communication, as we want to define it as we speak together about that subject, is the meeting of meaning. When my meaning meets your understanding across the bridge of words, body postures, tones of voice, all these various forms of communication, then we can say, we have really communicated. But even as I have given you that definition, two groups of you have heard it differently. You objective people have heard, yes, when my factual meaning gets across to that other person's mind, then we've really communicated. You subjective people have heard it, yes, when the meaning of the way I'm feeling about the matter is really understood, then we have communicated. Now let me illustrate it this way. Let's say we have two people here. One is a very objective, factual person, and we're going to make that the man, seeing as how that's Jack. And then the other one is the subjective feeling type person. That's me. And you have not really talked deeply for the last 3 weeks. And so you have set aside 3 hours to go out to dinner and really talk. And so you spend the first hour talking about what's been going on with the kids, at work, your schedules, and with your friends. And at the end of that hour, the subjective person's cup is already 45% full. This subjective person is about five. Now, then they spend an hour, you spend out now about another hour talking about a problem that he's having with a client, then what you want to do for next year's vacation, and how you're doing with your financial planning. At the end of the second hour, his cup is 85% full. Her cup is about 15. So the next hour you spend talking about what you're learning in Bible study and what you'd like to happen with the couples that you're working with and some significant problems with the kids. Getting down to more of a feeling level here. At the end of the 3 hours, his cup is almost at the top. Her cup, maybe 45%. And so you leave the restaurant and he thinks, what a fantastic time of in-depth communication we've had. And she's thinking, we've only just begun. And he's saying, hey, that was so great. Let's do this again next month. And she's saying, what about tomorrow? Now, for you subjective feeling people, I don't have to explain what's happened here. But for you objective factual people, let me explain what's happened here. See, for a subjective feeling type person to feel that they have actually communicated deeply, we've got to talk about feelings. about what's going on inside here, about how you're doing inside, not just facts. In fact, a very good communication question for this person to ask this person, if you don't know how else to do it, is to say, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being high, how are you feeling right now as a mom? How are you feeling right now as a wife? How are you feeling right now in your job? How are you feeling right now as a daughter? How are you feeling right now as a friend? How are you feeling right now as a Christ one? See what I'm saying? And then if you really wanted this person's cup to just flow all over the place here, you tell her, I realize this can be reversed, but you tell that person how you're really feeling about something. Harder for you, you bet. But oh, then she's going to feel like her communication cup is filled to overflowing. Someone has said you can't know anyone unless you communicate with them. You can't love anything you don't know. Therefore, the depth of love existing between a husband and a wife will largely depend on the amount and depth of their communication. Now, friends, it's complex. Communication is complex. There are actually 6 messages that are involved in the communication process, and this is why it gets complex. You don't have to copy this. It won't help you a bit. I just want to show you how complicated it is. What you mean to say, what you actually say, what the other person hears, what the other person thinks he hears, what the other person says about what you said, and what you think the other person says about what you said. Difficult, huh? Let me show you how Jack and I went through this process in just 2 sentences in the little illustration about looking at the moon. What did I mean to say? Well, I meant to say, oh, that's such a gorgeous moon. I'm just feeling so romantic. What I actually said was, oh, isn't that a beautiful moon? What Jack could have heard, it was, yeah, the moon's bright. So what he thinks he hears is, it's a nice night to take a walk. So what he says about it, what I said was, yes, it's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by. And what I think he said about what I think he says about what I said is, I don't feel romantic. We can say 2 sentences and totally miss each other, can't we? Unless we begin to understand this, and unless we begin to ask questions and clarify what's really going on. Because we are constantly communicating encoded messages. We do it even when we don't want to do it. Now, Jack is much better at saying what he means and meaning what he says than I am, because he is a factual person. But he still speaks encoded messages. He'll come in and say, what time is dinner? Well, now, wouldn't you think that was a simple one-level question? And what most of you wives would think anyway was, boy, he's wanting dinner as soon as I can fix it. Well, you'd be wrong, see? What he's actually saying is, do I have time to exercise before dinner? If I don't know that, I'm hurrying up dinner when he wants it delayed. We were driving along with a couple after spending a day with them, and all of a sudden this woman said, it's 5:00. Well, now, wasn't that interesting? We all had watches. We all knew it was 5:00. But we had been talking about this very thing. And so I kind of laughed and I said, okay, Jeannie, what are you really saying? Well, what Jeannie was really saying was, do I have time to go home and check on the children before we go out to eat? If we had not asked, she probably would have gone through the whole dinner hour frustrated, because she wouldn't have asked. Why are we like that? We just don't like to put ourselves out, do we? And we're a little bit afraid that our pride gets in the way to really let people know what we really want. And that's too bad, too. We need to work on that. We need to keep asking questions, the what do you mean kind of questions, to clarify. But let's just do a little exercise here on different ways of communicating. I want you couples to put down what you've got in your lap. I don't mean all the way to the floor, but just stick it on your lap. Turn toward each other. Turn toward each other. And cross your arms. And lean away from each other. Okay? Just lean slightly away from each other. You got that? Okay. Now, with absolutely no expression in your voice at all, say, I like you. Can't do it? Now, come on. Okay. Good. Now, stay the same position, but with as much expression in your voices as possible, say, I like you. Okay? Good. Now, say I like you. You can relax now and with your arms. Instead. Say I like you in a non-verbal way. Okay? No words. Just say I like you. Okay, some of you did it with a pat, some of you did a little hug, some of you did it with a kiss, some of you did it with a little hand on the cheek. Now tell me, what communicated to you I like you more? The last one. Most of you? Content, word experts say, is just like 7% of what you say. I mean, communicates only 7%. And the tone is about 38%. Nonverbal communication, 55%. And you've already had some illustrations of that. The hand on the thigh, what did that communicate? I mean, worlds. So we need to not only clarify, but we need to be very, very aware of our tones of voice. And I had one lady tell me, she said, my husband always sounds angry to me when he speaks. And I said, well, does he sound angry or is he angry? Saddest thing was, she said, I don't know. She'd never ask. And she needed to say, are you angry? To let him know that at least he was sounding that way to her. And for them to talk that through. But also, he needed to clarify what it was that was causing him to sound angry. Ephesians 4:15 is the key little passage to me that we need to filter all of our words through. Ephesians 4:15 talks about that we are not to be immature children, but rather speaking the truth in love. We are to grow up in every way unto him who is the head, even Christ. Speaking the truth in love. Oh, my friends, if we could just filter all of our words through that little passage, we'd be way ahead, wouldn't we? So often we're so blunt that it's not loving. It's not kind. So often we hesitate and we don't tell the truth because we're afraid. And that's not loving. So you've got to marry those two to be truthful and kind. Truthful in love, that passage says. Proverbs 3:3-6 says, never forget to be truthful and kind. Same two concepts. Hold these virtues tightly. Write them deep within your heart. If you want favor with both God and man and a reputation for good judgment and common sense, then trust the Lord completely. Don't ever trust yourself. In everything you do, put God first. And he will direct you and crown your efforts with success, including never forget to be truthful and kind. God can do it if you'll let him. Now, we need to be aware of the asking of the questions, to be vulnerable to answers, and to be open to one another. There are a lot of commitments that must be made in the communication process. One of the communication commitments is that we must make a commitment to be a revealer of what's going on inside of us. Now, to some of you, that is a bigger commitment than to others. We all fall into the category of kind of being natural revealers and natural concealers. Jack and I would fall into those categories. It's much easier for me to express what's going on inside of me than it ever has been for Jack. But even a revealer will quit revealing if we feel as though you're not open to what we're saying, if we experience ridicule. For instance, I could stand up here and say you may be thinking that you are seeing quite a self-confident woman up here that really isn't that afraid to speak to a group. And in one sense, you would be this much right. But in another great sense, I'm always scared. I always feel inadequate. And I'm always hanging on to that man's coattails, mentally. Now see, if I feel your acceptance in this, why then I'll peel off another layer, won't I? And I'll say, yeah, the things that have been going on in the last 3 weeks of my life are scary. And it takes a special trust. And God's doing some special things in our lives. And He is, friends, and He is faithful, and He does answer prayer. And I'm not going to get going on that, honest. And, you know, as long as I feel your acceptance, yeah, I'll keep peeling off layers. Not even talking straight. That's because I can't have any water. So excuse me. But I will. I'll take off those layers and share more with you. But the minute I feel like, oh, come on, Carol, you're just saying that, what happens? Well, I pull back. We do that, don't we, with each other? So we must give each other freedom. But Jack has made the commitment somewhere along in our lifetime of being that revealer to me of his true, true feelings. He didn't probably go through the process that another man I read about did. One man I read about realized that his silence and not being able to really reveal what was going on inside of him was selfishness. And it didn't show his wife, who longed for deeper communication, real love. He confessed that selfishness to God as sin, because it was the sin of lack of love and willingness to change. And so he realized, this man made the second step of realizing that love was not a feeling, but a decision. Often it is that, my friends. We trust that it is a feeling a great many times, but love is basically a decision, isn't it? I will love, even when I don't feel loving. And then he made a decision that by God's grace, he was going to learn to be a good communicator, no matter what the cost. And he did. And Jack has. And so when he is in the hospital, he's able to share with me his fears as well. And we can cry and pray together and be one. Commitment to be a revealer. It may mean a commitment for you to be vulnerable to the what do you mean questions. You know, there are people who are so threatened with a what do you mean question that they'll come back, well, you should know what I mean. Now, friends, I trust there's no one here like that because of the fact that we need to be more mature in that than that. We need to ask God for the kind of maturity that we can handle that kind of question. But if we have some here, let me make this suggestion to your spouse. Until your husband or wife gets to the place where they can answer the what do you mean questions with openness, try going through a whole week without asking a question. But make the statement the same as you would ask a question. In other words, don't say, well, what do you mean? Are you frustrated? Just make a statement. I get the feeling that you're frustrated, and it probably has something to do with something that happened at work. See what I mean? You're making a statement as opposed to asking a flat-out question. It's a terribly hard thing to do. I tried it for a whole week myself just to see if I could do it. I just about killed myself. But it can be done. And you can. It takes practice. Friends, that's what Jack meant when he said marriage takes work. Communication takes work. It takes work learning how to ask the right questions and when, or to make the right statements, to make I statements as opposed to you statements. Most of you know what I mean by that. But don't say, you're judging me. That's a you statement. It's an accusatory statement. It puts the other person on a defensive. And in communication, we want to take responsibility for our own feelings. And so we say, you know, I'm feeling left out. Or I'm feeling strange. Or I'm feeling that I've made you angry about something. I'm feeling. So there's a commitment to learn to be a revealer of what's going on inside of you. And of course, you that are better at revealing, the responsibility for you is to realize how to ask the non-threatening questions and still get the answers that you need to know. Part of that is restating what you think the other person has said. In other words, instead of saying, "Are you frustrated by what you said?" say, "You know, what I heard you just say is," and then you repeat it and let them sort it out for you. You go back several times on that. There's a commitment also in the communication process to not let one of the primary deterrents of communication grip your lives. And one of the primary deterrents of good communication is simply that we are too busy. You heard about the fellow who had his hand on the television knob and he turned to his wife and he said, "Now, is there anything you want to say to me before football season starts?" Some wives don't laugh at that one. There is a price to pay, my friends. And it may mean a little loss of sleep. It may mean missing your favorite television program. It may mean cutting out one of the things that you're doing in the community or even at church. But this is priority. We had the delightful opportunity of sitting for one day under Dr. Norm Wright. Dr. Norm Wright, I think of being as Mr. Marriage Counselor. He's written about 50 books on marriage and teaches that out in California as a family practice counselor and so on. Dr. Wright allowed several of us to sit in while he interviewed an engaged couple in a premarital session with their permission, of course. Dr. Wright asked them this question. He said, "Tell me, what makes you think you're going to make it?" And this couple said exactly what you and I would have said. "Well, we really love each other." "Yes, what else?" "Well, we're really committed to this." "Yes, what else?" "Well, we really feel it's God's will for our lives." "Yes, what else?" Well, you know, he just kept going until he didn't have anything further to say. Finally, they ran out of gas, and he said, "Let me just say something to you." He said, 90% of the couples that I get in practice who are on the verge of a divorce have said the same things you've said. What makes you think you're going to make it?" Gulp. They were silent, as we were. And then Dr. Wright smiled to take the edge off of what he was saying, but he said, "Let me give you two things that I feel will help you make marriage for the long haul." And these were the two things. He said, number one, put into your budget time and money for some kind of a marriage retreat every year. Jack and I about fell off our seats. Why? Because that's when you work on it. And Jack and I realize that we give these marriage seminars frequently, but we've been the one that have profited the most. Why? Well, we're constantly reminding ourselves of things that we ought to be doing all of the time. But what does that take? Time. Priority. Learning. Jack and I try to take in one every year ourselves, because we know there's much more we can learn on this. So that was number one. Secondly, he said, date. Don't ever stop dating. And I wanted to get up and say, yay! Because we've been preaching this. There are things, my friends, that you talk about on dates out from the family, a way that you never think to talk about at home. Now, don't save up the heavies for dates, or else soon you're not dating. Save the fun things for dates. But Dr. Wright goes on to say there are two primary ways that we fell in love. And they're the same ways that we grow in love. Two ways that we fell in love, there are others, but these are two important ones, was that we did enjoyable things together, didn't we? We had fun together. We went out and saw things and did some recreational sports and so on. We did fun things together. Well, that's the way you grow in love, too. But so often in marriage, we quit doing enjoyable things together. And secondly, the way you fall in love is by reinforcing behavior that you appreciate about the other one. And it's another one that as we were engaged, we just would build each other up continually, wouldn't we? We'd reinforce what we really liked in the other by making all these wonderful complimentary remarks about them. And then somehow when we say, I do, we stop doing that. How sad. Because true love has no maximum. So there's a commitment not to be too busy. And then the last commitment is the commitment to keep on being vulnerable to one another. Open and vulnerable. To keep asking, even when you don't feel like it. And I'm going to give you just one illustration of this. It was probably 3 years ago now, 3 or 4 years ago, when Jack and I had a seminar here in November. And it was speaking here. You all who are speakers, you can imagine, it's a little awesome in this place. And it kind of intimidates me to begin with. And then it had been one of those weeks that had been a real exciting week for me. We'd had a woman's staff conference that week before. And remember what I said, when I get nervous, I start talking faster and faster? Well, that is very, very true. And so as I'm getting more and more stimulated with all these staff women and so on, my friends, I am just getting revved up. I mean, I am going. Well, then we had a couples conference. And our favorite nephew and his wife flew in from Detroit for it. And we sat down at down at the tables downstairs at King James. Ten people, five couples, who didn't know each other. Well, sir, I pushed my little Miss Hostess button. And so how did you get here, you know? And pretty soon, this was not a fist on the thigh. This time it was a hand on the knee. And under the table, I feel my husband's patting my knee. And what he is saying in nonverbal language is, simmer down. I got the message. But I couldn't. And so the whole next day, I'm speaking, and that stimulates me too, see? And so I'm getting more and more revved up. And several times during the day, Jack leaned over to me very quietly and said, honey, simmer down. Try. So that night we got home, and I put my arms around him, and I said, do you love me? Now, husbands, if you've been married longer than 6 weeks and your wife asked you that question, you know that's not her real question, is it? Okay. Jack knew. We were both dead tired, but he said, well, of course I love you. And I said, well, I need that assurance right now. And he said, well, for what reason? And I said, well, sometimes I guess I feel like you love me, but I'm not sure you like me. Now, by this time, I have to tell you, I'm feeling really foolish. And I'm feeling like, oh, let's forget this whole thing. I'm just going to say, oh, forget it. But I want you to notice, I got up and wrote down this conversation verbatim about 10 minutes after it happened because I realized we'd done something right for a change. And I want you to notice how I refused to stop telling him how I felt, even though I wanted to. And Jack refused to keep on asking. He kept on asking, even when he was dead tired, to try to get to the heart. So I said, sometimes I guess I feel like you love me, but maybe sometimes you don't like me. And Jack said, well, what has given you that impression? What have I done that would cause you to feel that way? And I said, well, several times today you've told me to quiet down. And he says, well, but you've been hyper all day. I was trying to help you. And I said, I think I know that, but when it's several times, I think you can't like me when I'm that way. Jack said, but you need to accept the fact that the reason is, I want to help you. And I sighed. I said, my head does, but my heart doesn't always. And Jack said, honey, I love you and I like you. And he gave me a big hug and we went to bed. Do you notice every single question Jack asked was a fact question. The answer I gave him was a feeling answer. And that's okay when we understand each other. Commitment to listen. I mean a commitment to communicate feelings. A commitment to not to be so busy that you're going to not really work at this. And then a commitment to be vulnerable to one another. You see, friends, our goal in communication is not my mouth to your ear. You know, cliche communication. That's not what we want. And our goal isn't even my mind to your mind. Oh, we get a lot of facts talked about that way. And our goal really isn't even my heart to your heart, though we're getting down to the feeling level now. But our goal as couples to be one is my soul to your soul. And God can help us do just that.
It was a Saturday morning. This is a true story. It really happened. They'd gotten up on a Saturday morning. It was kind of a lazy day. They were not working. They didn't have a whole lot planned. And before the day had even gotten started, they had a little fight with one another. Not a major issue, just kind of a little misunderstanding. And so they were just slightly ticked at one another. And in the process of getting dressed, she asked him if he would help her with the zipper on the back of her dress. So he said, sure. As he walked over, he took the zipper and he went zip, 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 zip. And walked away and left it unzipped. Well, you know, she stood there kind of dumbfounded, not knowing what to think or what to do, and continued getting dressed and went about her business. And he did. And that afternoon, she'd gone shopping. She came back from shopping, pulled in the driveway, got the groceries out of the back seat of the car, started to walk toward the house, and then noticed that her husband was working on the other car, and he was under the car, half under and half out. And of course, the part that was out was the bottom half. Well, she looked over the situation, set the groceries down on the trunk of the car, walked over, reached down, took the zipper on his pants, and went zip, 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 and left them unzipped, picked up her groceries, and triumphantly walked in the house, thinking that she'd gotten revenge on his little trick that morning with the zipper on the back of her dress. Well, she walked into the kitchen, and there was her husband standing there. Oh. Can you see the expression on her face? Huh? What are you doing here? She asked. What do you mean, what am I doing here? I live here. Well, who's that out of the car? Oh, that's Joe next door. He's helping me work on the car. Oh, man. So they go rushing out of the house to find out how Joe's doing. Well, Joe is not doing very well. When she pulled this little zipper trick on his pants, he was so stunned that he raised up and hit his head on the bottom of the car and knocked himself out cold. And so he just lay in there out cold. Well, you know, they looked at one another. They didn't know what to do. And Joe didn't come too, and they got very concerned. So they rushed in the house, or one of them rushed in and called the paramedics, dialed 911, and got, you know, the ambulance came roaring out. And these two paramedics get out of the car and get the gurney out of the back of the ambulance and begin to kind of gingerly pull Joe out from underneath the car, not to hurt him or anything. And they start to get him on the gurney. Well, in the process of all this, they want to know what happened. Well, these two guys get to laughing so hard that they drop Joe. Onto the concrete drive, and he breaks his shoulder. Well, you know, by the time Joe comes to and finds out all that has happened to him and who's at fault and so forth, he ends up suing. his neighbors, the ambulance company, and the two paramedics. Now, of course, that's the kind of a world we live in today. Now, that really happened. That's a true story. But the moral of that is, be careful about those little Saturday morning disputes that take place between, and today's Saturday. So, you know, anything can happen. Conflict. How do we handle it? Do we let it go on and on and on? And, you know, it can cause all kinds of dilemmas that affect not only us, but our whole family and maybe others as well. Joe next door, for instance. Just because of a little conflict between the two of us that goes unresolved. I have a very dear friend here in Colorado Springs. He's a dentist, and I've known him for many, many years. And about 2 years ago at Christmas time, I got a call from him just before Christmas. And I know his voice very well, so I knew immediately who it was. I said, "What's happening?" And he says, in a very emotion-packed, downcast voice, I could tell. He says, "Jack, Linda is divorcing me." Well, I couldn't believe it. And so we continued to talk a little bit on the phone, and I said, "Hey, let's get together and you know, talk this over eyeball to eyeball." And so we met someplace a day later, the next day, for coffee or lunch or something, and sat and talked. And we got together several times. Even Carol and I got together with he and his wife, trying to get the thing resolved, but it had gone too far. And one of the things that came out of those conversations with both of them together, and then with him especially by himself, is they had been married for 27 years. Never once in that 27 years had they ever really resolved a conflict that developed between the two of them. Their response was pretty much always the same. He would get mad. They'd have a conflict. He'd get mad. She would withdraw. They would sweep it under the carpet, forget about it, go on about their business, and then either that same one or another one would rear its ugly head. And they never took the time. They never saw the necessity of sitting down and talking their way through a conflict to resolve it so that both of their needs could be met, whatever that was with regards to the conflict. How about you? Where are you? You know, conflict in marriage is very natural. It's going to happen. We all have them. And it can be a very healthy thing if we know how to handle it properly. We can learn a great deal about each other, about ourselves. And it can be a stimulating thing to make our future brighter. So it's not that we want to try and avoid conflict, but we want to learn how to handle it in a way that is constructive and healthy for our relationship. Someone was telling me last night, I can remember exactly how he said it, relationships are not really a big deal. There are a million little deals. And that's what conflicts are often. They're little deals. But when we stack them up unresolved, one on top of the other, day in, month out, year, like my friend, and never get resolved, then it drives us apart. Just gradually but surely drives us apart. And his wife had just gotten fed up with that kind of an approach to conflict. And she had found someone else also who would listen to her, who would not get mad at her. And so they are divorced now. How do we handle conflict? The primary deterrent to conflict resolution is pride. The primary deterrent to conflict resolution is pride. There's a lot in the scriptures about pride. First Peter, if you got your Bibles, well, you don't need to turn to this. Let me just read it to you. First Peter 5, just a couple of verses here. It says, clothe yourselves with humility. This is 5, 5, and 6. Clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. In other words, the idea I think that's expressed there is, you know, every morning when we get up and we spend a little time with the Lord in prayer, we just sort of say, now, Lord, help me to take the humble position today. Help me to be a humble person, to act in accordance with what I know you want me to do. Clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. That's pretty stiff opposition. God opposes the proud. And some of us have experienced that. But he will honor us if we are willing to take the humble position. So the primary deterrent to conflict resolution is pride. We need to get rid of that. Lousy, stinking human pride. The primary principle to keep in mind to successfully resolve conflict is this. Refuse to win. David Augsburger, a little book called The Creative Power of Conflict, makes this statement about this issue of a husband-wife approaching conflict with an I win, you lose type of attitude. He says, if you notice that when a husband or wife fights to win with the declared objective of forcing the other to admit defeat, somehow then everyone loses. When the husband and wife enter conflict, each afraid of losing, each determined to win alone, they seldom realize they're attempting the impossible. Marital conflict is not a win and lose matter. It's a win-win, we're both win, or a lose-lose, we're both lose kind of fight. Defeat or victory are never experienced by only one of a pair. Both win in creative resolution of the conflict, or both lose in widening gaps of misunderstanding. But when one sets out to win alone, he or she is tempted to use foul tactics that only lovers have access to and anger enough to utilize. And you know what I mean by foul tactics. You know, if you've been married for 3 years, you've gotten to know one another well enough to know the buttons to push to get the kind of response from your spouse. You know the kind of buttons to push to make him angry or make her sad or hurt her feelings. Or, you know, that's the kind of information that only lovers have. And then when we get angry enough to utilize them, see, it really can do a great deal of damage. So the primary principle to keep in mind to successfully resolve conflict is to refuse to win. I am not the kind of a person who feels that we as human beings can follow 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, do those 7 things, and then draw the line, and then every time this is going to happen, here's going to be the result. We're too complicated as human beings for that to happen. Nevertheless, in spite of that, I want to share with you a little 7-point plan that has worked for us, and we know has worked for other people, on how to get at this matter of resolving conflict. Now, I'm talking primarily about the kind of conflicts that I would refer to as generic. By that I mean they are the kind that are likely to happen more than once. Every time a certain set of circumstances comes to bear in our relationship, bingo, it causes a conflict between us over that particular issue. And those circumstances can arise more than once. So we're really fighting about the same thing. It may be a little bit different circumstance, but nevertheless, it's the same thing. And that's what I mean by generic. And the only way we can resolve that kind of a conflict or a problem in our relationship is getting at a generic solution. One that every time that happens, if we try this, we know it will work. And that's what we're after here. A number of years ago, Carol was kind of describing that situation when she said I would come home from a week-long conference or a trip, and she'd greet me at the door, and and throw her arms around me, give me a hug and a kiss, and then say, tell me all about the trip. And then I'd tell her in 10 minutes flat, you know, all about the trip or the conference or whatever it was. And she didn't like that. And her response was, I ought to give her more information. Well, that actually happened a number of years ago, several times. It was during the days when Lynn was still growing up. She was in school, and I was traveling in my job, and Carol had to stay home, as she said, with Lynn, the dog, the laundry, and dial of prayer. And so I would be gone for a week or two, get home, and we'd go through that same little routine. And both of us would get mad, and we'd spend the whole evening trying to get it resolved. That happened a half a dozen times. And finally we realized, hey, we've got a problem, and it's going to happen every time I come home. We better talk about it and get it resolved. We didn't even know about these seven steps in those days, but as we look back on it, it's exactly what we did. We sat down, and the first thing we tried to do was define the problem or the issue of disagreement. Now, that may sound easier than it is. Because you have two different perspectives on this thing. And it's probably going to take some pretty good dialogue before both of you can come to the point where you say, you agree, yeah, this is our problem. This is what is really the issue at stake here. And then you need to write that down. Well, we talked about that. And the conclusion that we came to is this. This was the problem. When I hit the front door after being gone for a week or two on a trip, when I hit the front door, Carol had a need for intimacy, closeness, and talk. Now, she's the extrovert. I had a need for just the opposite. Quietness, distance, emotional distance, no talking. I mean, I had been gone for a week or two, and during the time I had been gone, I had been constantly interacting with people. I mean, my E button, my extrovert button, had to be pushed most of the time when I was gone. And by the time I hit the front door, after a week or two of that, I'd had it. I didn't care about relating anymore. I didn't want to talk. I'd been talking the whole time I'd been gone. Actually, we had the wrong jobs. I should have stayed home, and she should have gone on trips. But, you know, God didn't work it out that way. So our needs were entirely different. Well, now you look at that and you say, good night, there is no solution. That's an impossible situation. Because I had to keep traveling and she had to keep staying home. Well, it would be if it wasn't for God. He can come up with some of the most fabulous ideas for us if we just commit them to Him and talk them over with Him, pray about it, and then talk about it together. And so that's what we began to do. The second step is, we talked about how do each of us contribute. Well, we'd already discussed that in the matter of defining the problem or issue. It was that we had needs that were just totally different than one another. And then the third step is to begin to brainstorm and all the possible solutions. Now, as you know, a brainstorming session is kind of open season. You don't start shooting anybody's idea down during a brainstorming session. You wait till later to do that. So you get down all those crazy, good, out-to-lunch ideas that you can. You write them down on a piece of paper. And then after you've exhausted that, then you go back and you begin to discuss each one of them. And as you're doing that, what you're looking for is one that you can agree on that might work. Agreeing on one solution to try, and then at the same time, agreeing on how each of you will contribute toward the solution. What you each, because invariably each of you will have a part to play in the solution to the conflict. There may be a time when it is one-sided, but most of the time there's a part for both of you to play. And that's what we did. In the process of doing the brainstorming, Carol slipped in a little statement one time that we jotted it down. Didn't think too much about it at the time. But when we got to point 4 and 5 and 6, it began to loom bigger and bigger and bigger as a possible solution. She made the little statement, just kind of off the cuff. Well, I've been home for 2 weeks without talking to you. I suppose I could wait 24 more hours. In fact, it was said in just a little bit of disgust. But we put it down on paper, and later we came back to it, and I asked her, I said, honey, what about this? Are you serious about that? Could you live for 24 more hours and give me that space to not have to tell you all about the trip? She said, well, I guess so, sure. Yeah, I could make that. I said, well, if you would do that, then I'll commit myself to, after a good night's sleep in my own bed and taking care of some stuff I need to take care of, that the next day, sometime during the day, I'll sit down and we'll talk about it, and I'll tell you all about the trip and answer all your questions. I said, is that fair enough? She says, yeah. So we tried it. And the next time I was going on a trip, actually, I'll have to admit that I'd gotten to the place where I wasn't even looking forward to coming home, because I knew that that first statement out of her mouth was going to be, tell me all about the trip, and I knew I wouldn't want to do that. But the next time I left, and when I was heading home, my whole attitude was different. I was anxious to get home because I knew that I'd get the nice, warm welcome, the hug and the kiss when I got home, but I wouldn't get, tell me all about the trip. And that's the way it happened. And so I got home that night, and she greeted me warmly. We had a nice dinner together, and kind of relaxed that evening, watched a little TV, got caught up on the mail, played with Lynn a little bit, played with the dog some, got a good night's sleep in my own bed, got up the next morning, did some things in my office that I needed to get done. And then that afternoon, we sat down, and I took care of my part of the bargain. I told her. We took an hour or so to talk about the trip. See, one of the problems was that while I was traveling, I saw a lot of her friends. And she wanted to know about her friends, what, you know, what was going on in their lives and how they were doing. And so we the next day we sat down, and I caught her up on all that stuff. And it worked. It's been the solution. Of course, we don't travel apart from each other much anymore, but in those days we did, and it resolved the problem. Now, what if it doesn't work? Well, you got to take a little self-inventory here. So you set a time to review your progress. You decided, you know, on 3, 4, and 5, and 6, you came up with some kind of a solution you're going to try. But then after you've tried it a couple of times, you need to take an inventory. Is it working? If it is, fine. You know, get on with the rest of life. If it isn't working, then you need to go back to step 3. Pull out all those old notes in the brainstorming, maybe do some more, and then go through 4, 5, and 6 again and try another solution. We have never done this when we've had to do it more than twice. In fact, most of the time we can come up with a solution. But see, it takes communicating. You got to talk your way through it. Now, as I said at the outset, I realize that we as human beings are more complicated than a little 7-step procedure can probably work every time. But if you've got one of those generic problems, one that's cropped up again and again and again, like we have, I would challenge you to try this. We were sitting talking with a couple down in Texas 2 or 3 years ago, and we had not intended to get into this with them at all. And we'd had dinner, and we were sitting around talking afterwards, and as we were talking, they began to tell us about a conflict that they had had. It had started over 5 years ago. Finally, after 2 or 3 years of trying to resolve it, they'd given up and just swept it under the carpet, but it still came up every once in a while, and it always created real anger between the two of them. And they'd just given up on it. And so we said, hey, could we maybe talk it through with you, give you some a little approach to it that might be different than you've tried. And I said, sure. So we went through this with them. Probably took us 2 hours to help them work all the way through it. And they came up, not we, they came up with a solution they'd never thought of before because they'd never brainstormed on it. And they had never really identified what the problem was. They'd never defined it clearly. And so I would challenge you to give this a try. I was sitting talking with a group of businessmen, oh, 5 or 6 of us, around a conference table for lunch one time. And the guy sitting right across the table from me was a lawyer. And we were in the boardroom of his law firm. And I was asking him about what he did. I'd never met him before and what kind of law he practiced. And he told me it was corporate law. And he says, but it's amazing to me how many people come in to see me about when they're about ready to get a divorce. I says, is that right? He says, you practiced it? No. He says, they know that I'm a Christian and that I've been able to help other people. So they come to me and they want some advice. I said, what's the biggest issue that comes up as you talk to people who have come to that place? They're ready to call it quits. What's the biggest issue you run into in terms of their marital conflict? Without any hesitation, he gave me this answer, and I wrote it down. Here's what he said. The biggest problem I run into is that people refuse to accept the fact that they're married to a human being. So whether you realize it or not, you're married to a human being with all of the faults and fallacies and sin that's involved with that. And, of course, you're one too. They refuse to accept the fact that they're married to a human being. They have in mind at the outset that they're going to change this person so that they will become someone they can live with. After several years, their marriage partner doesn't change in the way that they think they ought to. And so they opt for divorce. Listen, folks. You can't change your marriage partner. And the harder you try, the harder they're going to dig in their heels. That's human nature. God can change us. And what we need to pray is, if we're having problems, if there are conflicts that are unresolved, is what we need to pray is, God, change this marriage beginning with me. That's where we need to start, beginning with me. What adjustments do I need to make? See, we're human beings and we need God's help, don't we? Huh. Well, let's have a word of prayer and we'll go to lunch. Father, we thank you for your great faithfulness to us. When we cry out to you in need, you are faithful to answer and come up with creative alternatives and ideas that perhaps we have never thought of. So I pray that you'll help us to seek your guidance, your counsel, your wisdom on a daily basis. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.